And we've been reading through Luke's Gospel, and in the last few weeks we've been looking at chapter 5. And in that chapter we've seen Jesus facing more and more sharp criticism from one group of people. We first meet those people in chapter 5, verse 17. One day, as Jesus was teaching, Pharisees and teachers of the law, who had come from every village of Galilee and from Judea and Jerusalem, were sitting there. Meet the Pharisees. Who were these people? Well, the Pharisees were a particular group of Jewish folk. They were people who were very concerned about maintaining their Jewish identity. And what that meant for them was that they were determined to keep the Jewish law, the law that God gave to Israel through Moses, and they were determined that they were going to keep it as rigorously as possible. The Pharisees were people who followed a very strict way of life, and they did it because they believed that that pleased God. And they encouraged other Jewish folk to do the same. Being a Pharisee wasn't a job. It wasn't like being a priest. Most of the Pharisees were laymen. They were men who earned their living doing the same sorts of jobs as other people. But the thing that made them different was that they were people who took their religion very seriously. Being a Pharisee meant that you were part of a national movement to take God's law seriously. And alongside the Pharisees, you read in verse 17 about teachers of the law. That's the phrase in the NIV. In some other translations, you'll simply find the word scribes. And the teachers of the law, the scribes, well, they were people with a definite job. They were the experts on the Jewish law. It was their job to teach the law to other people. It was their job to act as judges in the Jewish law courts. And these scribes might belong to the Pharisee movement and see things the Pharisaic way, or they might belong to other movements and groupings such as the Sadducees. Well, the scribes we've got here, they belong to the movement of the Pharisees. So what you've got in verse 17 is a large group of Pharisees who have come along to have a look at Jesus, and they brought with them their legal experts. Well, it doesn't take long for the Pharisees and the teachers of the law to start disapproving of Jesus. They soon decide that Jesus is not living the way that they think Jewish people should live. And you can see here in chapter 5 how their disapproval of Jesus becomes more and more definite and more open. The first point at which they disapprove of Jesus is when Jesus says to a paralyzed man in verse 20, "Your sins are forgiven." How do the Pharisees react? Verse 21, "The Pharisees and teachers of the law begin thinking to themselves, 'Who is this fellow that speaks blasphemy?'" They're obviously very shocked by what Jesus has said. But they don't say that openly. They keep their thoughts hidden. It's in their minds. In verse 30, they've got a different issue. Jesus has gone to a banquet at Levi's house, and Levi has invited along a crowd of tax collectors and notorious sinners. And Jesus and his disciples sit down and eat a meal with them. And again, the Pharisees and their scribes are shocked. And this time they do say something. But they don't say it to Jesus directly. Instead, they question Jesus' disciples. "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" Well, they may put the question to the disciples, but their issue isn't with the disciples, is it? They know very well that the only reason the disciples are at the banquet is because Jesus is there. But they're not ready to attack Jesus openly. So they criticize the disciples instead. And then there's the third issue. This time it's over eating and drinking. The Pharisees and their followers often fast as a sign that they're in mourning over the state of the world. But Jesus allows his disciples to feast and party. He encourages them to celebrate the wonderful thing that's happened, the fact that he's come, the fact that the kingdom of God has come to earth. And this time the Pharisees do challenge Jesus directly. Verse 33, they said to him, John's disciples often fast and pray, so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking. They're still not prepared to criticize Jesus' own behavior openly. But it's obvious what they're implying when they say this to Jesus. You're failing to uphold proper standards. You're failing to teach your disciples the same strict standards that we teach our disciples. Do you see the progression through those three incidents? First, they just criticize Jesus in their own thoughts. Then they go to his disciples and criticize them. And then they challenge Jesus to his face. But there's another progression in these verses too. The issues over which they disagree with Jesus become more and more serious. The first issue, remember, forgiveness of sins. Well, you could say that that's a matter of personal opinion. Jesus said to the paralyzed man, "Friend, your sins are forgiven." He didn't actually say, "I forgive you." He simply said that the man's sins were forgiven. And there was nothing at all in the Jewish law, the law of Moses, about whether it was right to say such a thing. The Pharisees couldn't have pointed to any passage which said, "You shall not say that someone's sins are forgiven." If you had questioned these Pharisees, they'd have had to admit that it was just their opinion that Jesus was out of order at that point. The second issue, though, was a bit more problematic. Jesus and his disciples went for dinner with a group of tax collectors and sinners. Well, again, that wasn't anything that the law of Moses said anything about. Jesus was doing something very unusual, very unconventional, something that all decent people would have disapproved of. But no one could say he was doing something that was against God's law. The worst you could say that he was that he was failing to show proper disapproval of other people's sins. But even the Pharisees couldn't have said that he himself was sinning. The third issue was even more serious. The issue of fasting. The fact that Jesus didn't order his disciples to fast. Because although it wasn't laid down in the law of Moses that Jewish people should fast regularly, it was something that all the religious teachers of Israel had been teaching for a very long time. Every God-fearing Jew fasted. And all the teachers of the law agreed that Jewish people should fast regularly. And here was Jesus telling his disciples that they could ignore one of the most basic religious duties for Jewish people. Do you see what's happening? The Pharisees are realizing step by step that Jesus is prepared to cross all their ideas of what is proper religious behavior. He's prepared to go against their personal opinions. But it's worse than that. He's prepared to go against all the social norms that respectable people follow. But it's worse than that. He's prepared to go against all the religious rules that we all take for granted. So first of all, they mutter against him. And then they start questioning his disciples. And then they challenge Jesus to his face. The battle lines are being drawn and they're firming up. Now, as we move on into chapter 6, we're going to see the next step in this mounting conflict. In chapter 5, we've got the Pharisees being suspicious, questioning, challenging. But by the time you get to verse 11 of chapter 6, the Pharisees have settled what they think of Jesus. It says this: they were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. They've decided Jesus is a menace. Jesus is a troublemaker. He's got to be dealt with. They're enraged with Jesus. From those first tentative thoughts in their minds, they've reached the stage now where they've got this burning anger against Jesus. And what's the issue now? Well, it's moved beyond a personal opinion issue, and it's moved beyond a social norms issue. It's moved beyond a universal religious practice issue. Something more serious now than any of those things. Their issue with Jesus now is God's law and whether Jesus keeps it or not. And the particular issue is the issue of the Sabbath. Here in chapter 6, verses 1 to 11, you've got two clashes between Jesus on the one side and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law on the other side. And it's a clash over the question of the Sabbath day and how the Sabbath is to be kept. As far as the Pharisees are concerned, Jesus simply isn't keeping the Sabbath. That's their accusation against him, that he's breaking God's law. Now let me warn you that these verses are complicated, and they've often been misunderstood in lots of different ways. And I don't think we're going to get through them this morning. But I hope we'll be able to get some things at least clear this morning. We're going to lay some foundations for understanding these verses. I think we need first to understand some things about the Sabbath day itself. What does the word Sabbath mean? Well, we often say it means rest. The Sabbath day is a rest day. And that's where the first misunderstanding comes in. The word from which the Sabbath comes, the Hebrew word, does mean to rest. But not in the sense of relaxation. Not in the sense of refreshment. It means rest in the sense of stopping doing something. You know, if I were describing a piece of machinery, I might say the wheel that had been spinning round came to rest. But that doesn't mean that the wheel started relaxing. It simply means that it stopped whirling round. It ceased what it had been doing. The Sabbath day is a cessation day. It's a stopping day. It's a day when you stop doing certain things. Now, when and how did the idea of a Sabbath day, a cessation day, begin? Well, it began with God himself. I want you to turn back to Genesis chapter 1, the first chapter in the Bible. This chapter tells us how God created and shaped the world in 6 days. For 6 days, God was working. He was making the world and all its basic structures, light and darkness, sea and sky, earth and dry land, sun and moon and stars, plant life, birds and fish, and on the 6th day, land animals, and finally human beings, mankind, the first man and woman. You can read in chapter 1 verse 27 how God created man and woman on that sixth day. And then when he had created them, he gave them work to do. Verse 28, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." That was to be man's work, to care for all the rest of creation. Man had to subdue the earth. He had to bring it under control. He had to build bridges across the rivers. He had to find ways of travelling across the oceans. He had to quarry stones. And he had to plant orchards. And then he had to care for the fish and the birds and the animals. God had been working throughout these 6 days, and he wanted man to work as well. So he gave man work to do. And then we read this in chapter 2, verse 2. "By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. The world was complete." So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And the word rested is that word from which we get the word Sabbath. It doesn't mean God was tired and that he decided he needed to relax and rest up for a while. It simply means he ceased. He ceased from all his work. His work of making the world was complete. So on the seventh day, he stopped from that work. But that doesn't mean, does it, that he had nothing to do? He'd stopped creating. He'd stopped making the world. But he was still very active. Now he had to uphold the world he had made. Now he had to govern it. He still had to keep the earth moving in its orbit round the sun. He still had to keep the grass growing. He still had to care for the man and woman he had made. Make their hearts beat. God wasn't idle on the seventh day, was he? But he was doing different work now. He had stopped from the work he had been doing on the 6 days, and now he was doing something different. The world was complete, and he had to look after the world. He had made man as the pinnacle of all creation, the most wonderful thing in all creation, his own image bearer. And now God was going to be interacting with the creation, and especially he was going to be interacting with man. God was going to be communicating with man, talking with him. He was going to enjoy a relationship with Adam and Eve. God had ceased from the work he had been doing for the past 6 days, but this seventh day was still going to be full of things for God to do. And that was the pattern for God himself. And God decided that human beings should follow the same pattern. After all, he'd made them in his image. He'd made them to be like him. So he wanted them to live their lives on the same pattern as his life. So we read this in chapter 2, verse 3. "And God blessed the seventh day." God pronounced a special blessing on this seventh day, this cessation day. He said, "This day is special. And this day will bring richer rewards than any other day. This day will offer greater happiness than any other day. I'm blessing this day." He blessed it. And it says he made it holy. Now think about that word holy. What does the word holy mean? It means something that's set aside for God. Something special because it belongs to God. In Old Testament times, God set aside one building for a holy temple. It wasn't to be used as a market or a concert hall. It was to be used as a dwelling place for God. It was to be used as a place to worship God. In New Testament times, God sets aside his people as holy. They're different from all other people. They belong to God alone. Their lives are to be spent serving God. Well, here, right back at creation, Genesis 2:3, God says, I'm setting aside every seventh day as a holy day. This day is to be kept special for myself. It's not for the same purposes as other days. It's reserved for me. And that wasn't something that God kept secret. This was something for Adam and Eve. It was written down. God told these first human beings, the parents of the whole human race, I've blessed every seventh day. I want it to be kept holy. So Adam and Eve, and they were to teach their children this, and their children's children, Adam and Eve were to live their lives according to the pattern of God's life. They were to work for 6 days at the work God had told them to do, subduing the earth, studying the beasts, caring for the beasts. They were to do that 6 days a week, and then the seventh day was to be different. It was to be used for different work, holy work. It was to be used for communicating with God, who wanted to communicate with them. It was to be used to worship God, to serve God in a direct way. Yes, on the other 6 days they were going to do God's will. But they must still set aside this seventh day as holy. They must serve him directly on this day. This is Mothering Sunday, isn't it? I hope that the children of this church care for their mums and love their mums in all sorts of indirect ways they show it. 364 days in the year, but there's still this one day where they say, we're going to show our love for mum directly. Well, God wanted Adam and Eve to serve him through the 6 days by working, looking after animals and subduing the earth. But then he wanted there to be this seventh day where they were having dealings directly with himself. It was set aside as holy. So the idea behind the Sabbath day, the cessation day, it wasn't that after human beings had worn themselves out working, subduing the earth for 6 days, then they should have a day for sleeping in and for entertaining themselves. That seems to be the idea that many Christians have. It was that they should have a day set aside as holy. They should have a day to be used for God himself. And when you think about it, that was the way that Adam and Eve used their very first full day here in this world. Remember, they were created on the sixth day. So their very first full day in this world was God's seventh day, the seventh day of God's creation week. Their first full day in the world was this day that God had blessed and set aside as holy. So before they started their 6 days of digging and building and pruning and making plans for the animals, and the first full day of their existence here in this world coincided with the seventh day of God's creation week, his Sabbath. They spent that first day of their life here in this world drawing near to God, worshipping God, serving God. Well, this is all very different, isn't it, from what some Christians have said about the Sabbath. Let me just pick up one obvious mistake that some Christians have made. I've heard lots of Christians say, the Sabbath was a command that God gave just for Israel. It was part of God's covenant with national Israel. And we're not Jews, so we don't have to keep that command. We're free from the bondage of Sabbath keeping. But it's perfectly clear here, the Sabbath wasn't given just to Israel. It was when Adam and Eve were created that God blessed a Sabbath and set it aside as holy. It's for the whole human race. Adam needed to have this 6 days, this 6 day, 1 day rhythm in his life. And Adam was going to teach that to his children, wasn't he? And they were going to teach that to their children. All human beings need that rhythm in their lives. They need to work, and then they need to stop working and to focus on God. And that's not a bondage. It's simply the way we're made. It's part of being in God's image. When human beings stop living in that way, they make themselves less godlike. They make themselves less human. And they pay the price for it. They get damaged. They suffer physical damage and mental damage and social damage. And most of all, they suffer spiritual damage. Human beings, wherever they live, at any point in history, need that 1 day in seven when they break away from other work to make God their undistracted priority. Your humanity, it gets warped. Your humanity is withered where that dimension is lost. Jesus said the Sabbath was made for man, not for Israel. Not just for Jewish people, but for man. Man needs the Sabbath. Jesus said so. The Sabbath was made for man. Now, of course, after the fall, human beings rebelled against this command, as they rebelled against every other command of God. The fact is that most human beings will have abandoned this 7 day pattern very early. But there was always a godly remnant who remembered it. You can see that in a man like Noah, even through that dreadful year when the ark was being tossed about on the waters of the flood, and just about every pattern of the created order had been disrupted. You can see that Noah was still determined to live his life in a 7 day rhythm. He sends out the dove, it returns to him. And 7 days later he sends it out again. And then 7 days later he sends it out again. He lives his life in units of 7 days. And the same is true of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. You can see the 7 day pattern of their lives at lots of points in Genesis. You come to Exodus, and you see it in Exodus chapter 16, when God first gives the manna to the Israelites. Now, it's important to see that this is before the Ten Commandments are given at Sinai. It's before God has made a covenant with Israel. But what you see is that the Israelites were already expected to live by the 7 day pattern, the 6-1 pattern. They're told that they must only collect as much manna as they need for any day until the 6th day comes. And then they must collect 2 days' supply so that they won't need to collect any on the Sabbath. And Moses says, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow's to be a day of cessation. It's to be a holy Sabbath to the Lord. And that's why they're not to collect manna on that holy day. So already before they became God's special nation, before God made the covenant with them at Sinai, God was bringing them back to the pattern that he had laid down right at the beginning. He wanted them to experience again the blessing of keeping Sabbath. That's the point, isn't it? People, even some Christian people, talk about the Sabbath as bondage. And they boast that they're now free from that bondage. Well, you wonder whether they've ever read Genesis 2:3. God blessed the Sabbath. God calls the Sabbath a blessing. And silly human beings call it a bondage. When it's used rightly, the Sabbath can be one of the greatest blessings that human beings can enjoy. It's like food, it's like marriage. Those lovely things that God gave to man from the very beginning. He told man, I'm encouraging you to eat from all the trees in the garden. They're my gift to you. Food. Says to man, I'm encouraging you to take this woman, whom I've made flesh of your flesh. It's my good gift to you. Marriage. These things are to be enjoyed. These things, God gives them to enrich life. Now the sad thing is this. That since the fall, human beings have become incapable of using any of God's gifts properly and fully. We don't value God's gifts rightly. We don't use them rightly. Having fallen out with God, the giver, we lose the capacity to enjoy God's gifts as they should be enjoyed. I don't know if you understand what I mean. Supposing I give my son, my imaginary son, a present. Could be anything. Let's say a bicycle. And then I say to my son, look, I'm going to teach you how to ride your bike. And he says, no, I can ride it perfectly well. He doesn't want me involved. I gave him the bike, but he doesn't want me to show him how to ride it. He wants to do it all independently of me. He wants my gift without me, the giver. So he gets on the bike. And he can't work out how to get it moving. Can't work out how you can sort of lift your feet off the floor to pedal it without the bike falling over. And that happens again and again and again, and he becomes more and more frustrated. And finally, after a lot of effort, he does manage to push off with one foot, and he moves a few yards, and then the bicycle falls over, and he skins his knee. And then he loses his temper, and he kicks the bike, and he shouts, stupid bike! And probably shouts, stupid dad for giving him this useless bike! And he walks off. And 3 months later, the bike is still lying there, abandoned and rusting. It's forgotten about. Well, that's the way godless people have treated all sorts of good gifts from God. It's the way more and more people in our society treat the gift of marriage, isn't it? They shout, it just doesn't work. It just makes people miserable. Just leads to domestic abuse. And so they abandon it. They just move in and out of relationships. They sleep with anyone they choose. They experiment with all sorts of perverted ways of life. They don't want God to teach them how to live together in a happy marriage. And then they finish up throwing out marriage completely and saying we're better off without it. They lose out on the blessing, the happiness that marriage can bring. And that's the way most people all through history and all across the world have treated the blessing of the Sabbath. Instead of saying, how wonderful to have one day where we don't need to dig and we don't need to plow and we don't need to build and we don't need to decorate our homes. How wonderful to have one day a week where we can get to know our Creator. Instead of seeing the Sabbath for being the huge blessing it is, they've abandoned it. And they've forgotten that God ever gave it. And they tried to make every day, 7 days a week, a day for working and getting richer and entertaining themselves and shopping. And the Sabbath has just been dumped like that rusty bicycle. That's the way it was with the Gentiles in Jesus' time. They just dumped the Sabbath. That's sad, isn't it? To think of millions upon millions of people all across the world who could have had the blessing of that one day. Of laying aside all the other back-breaking jobs to discover God. Sad. But perhaps there's something even sadder. And it's this. To realize that religious people couldn't use the Sabbath rightly either. That religious people, Jewish people, people who for whom the Sabbath had been written into their law, to realize that they couldn't enjoy it as a blessing from God because they didn't know God himself. That's what we're going to see in Luke chapter 6. We're going to be looking at these two episodes, and we're going to see that the Pharisees, with all their religion, with all their knowledge, with all their expert theologians, they had lost the capacity to benefit from the Sabbath. In the first episode, the Pharisees just go haywire because Jesus' disciples, when they're hungry, rub some ears of corn between their fingers and enjoy a snack. That really is bondage, isn't it? When the day for enjoying God becomes the day when hungry people are told they're not allowed to eat. And in the second episode, the Pharisees become even more angry because Jesus heals a man with a withered arm. I mean, can you get that? The Sabbath has become a day when a crippled man mustn't be restored to normality. The Sabbath has become a day when a man who's been disabled can't be healed. So hungry men can't be fed. And crippled men can't be healed. Because this is the Sabbath day. This is a holy day. That's how twisted the Pharisees had become. Instead of the Sabbath enriching human life, it had become a day for impoverishing human life. On any other day, you can feed people, but not on the Sabbath. On any other day, you can heal people, but not on the Sabbath. Instead of the Sabbath being a good gift, it had become something poisonous. It had been a day for perpetuating hunger and disability. That's how twisted the Pharisees had become. Here are the most religious people in the world. People who know more about God's book than anybody else. And yet they've taken this good gift from God and they've ruined it. They've twisted it into something horrible. Something callous and cold-hearted. Something inhuman. Say it again, the Sabbath is one of the richest and greatest blessings that God has given to human beings. But it's only that if it's used properly. But these religious people, these Pharisees, they weren't capable of using it properly because they didn't know the God who had given the gift. Just as the child in my story can't learn to ride the bike. It just becomes something that finishes up damaging him because he doesn't know the giver. So these Pharisees, with all their religion, didn't know God. No wonder they couldn't enjoy the Sabbath. No wonder they couldn't make full use of it. It's for worshipping God, but they didn't know God. It's for drawing near to God, but they didn't love God. They turned a blessing into a bondage. They turned a time of delight into a recipe for despair. The Lord Jesus came to save his people. And part of saving his people is that he teaches them to enjoy God's good gifts again. Here in this passage, we're going to see Jesus teaching men and women what the Sabbath is for, and teaching them how to use it rightly. He says in verse 5, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. He's talking about himself. He's saying that he's the one person who can teach us how the Sabbath is to be used. He's the one person who can train us how to use it and how to enjoy it. If he's the Lord of the Sabbath, then under his lordship we can learn to use the Sabbath. We can learn how to make it an enrichment for our souls. We can learn how to make it what it's supposed to be. We'll never do it on our own. We'll never do it just by trying to draw up rules and regulations. That's what the Pharisees tried to do. It's Christ, it's the Lord Jesus, who must teach his people how to break open the delights that are hidden in this good gift from God. Keeping Sabbath is hard, isn't it? Those of you who take seriously this God-given gift find it hard. Find it hard to know just how you're supposed to use this day. Find it hard to know just how you're to draw near to God on this day. Find it hard to know how to maintain the presence of God throughout this day. Well, there's one who can teach you. The Son of Man, Jesus, is the Lord of the Sabbath. That's the great thing that comes through in this passage. Not the fact that the Sabbath is commanded. That's been true since Genesis 2. But the fact that there's someone who can teach us how to use the Sabbath to full. He did. Here in this world, there's been one man who has used the Sabbath perfectly. There's been one man who has lived out this beautiful pattern to the full. There's been one man who never put a foot wrong when it came to this matter. And if we're united to him by his Spirit, and if he lives within us, then he, the Lord of the Sabbath, can teach us how to keep Sabbath too.